My love affair with Africa, South Africa specifically, but other places too, and why I divorced the LDS Church. So this was the beginning of the downfall for me, because I wanted to be a missionary to Africa since I was 12 years old. When I was in the Church of England and I was being confirmed, they asked me, my vicar asked me, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to be a missionary in Africa. And then I joined the Mormon Church when I was 23. And I thought, well, it's too late for a mission now. And I married Jim, and we thought, when the kids grow up, we're going to go on a mission together. We're going to, you know, go spread the gospel in another part of the world, and hopefully it'll be Africa. And it was. I asked on my application for a humanitarian mission, and I didn't get one. But this letter was signed by Gordon B. Hinckley, and I thought, he must have been inspired, because I wanted to do this, be a missionary in Africa, since I was 12 years old. So we arrive, and the very next day after we arrived, that accident occurred. And so I'm wondering, what do you think a loving Christian organization would do with a couple in that condition? That's exactly what happened. That's what we were called to do. And the reason we were called to the office is because of my husband's skills. We didn't go on a humanitarian mission that I wanted, because I'm just the woman, right? What I wanted didn't count. It was my husband's skills they wanted. So when we spent a week in the hospital, and we came out on, the accident happened on Sunday, and the next week on the Sunday, we came out of the hospital. And I think that my husband was in there the very next day. I'm not quite sure, but I think it was the very next day. And I stayed back at the mission home, and I was all alone with all of those injuries. So I had a fractured scaphoid, a fractured collarbone, this fractured wrist here that had to be fixed with screws, and then I had to have more surgery on it right here. I had a broken vertebrae in my back, and nobody said to me, do you want to go home? Do you need to go home? Maybe you need to go home. Nobody said that. We received no offers at all for any alternative. It was just, we need you in the office to start learning your duties, because the other couple has to go home. And Jim went in his neck brace, because he's very, very concerned to do his duty. That's what we went there for. And I was, because I was all alone in the mission home, I started to go in too, because I couldn't stand being all alone, so sick and injured, and I missed my family. And I had a terrible concussion, and it's, as you can imagine, with that crack on the head and all the bruising, I just had this awful concussion, and I was on pain meds. I couldn't even think straight. So when I said to the mission president, you're not going to send us home, are you? It was like, it was kind of a mixed up thing. And maybe he didn't get my message, but I wasn't saying I want to go home. What I was meaning is I couldn't bear to travel home in that condition. You're not going to send us home, are you? Because I was hurting so badly. I was in so much pain. And so, no, there was no talk about us going home. It was just, let's get you in the office and get you learning your skills and your duties. And within no time at all, my mission president would come in and he would throw down a stack of papers on my desk and say, I need these by 5:30 tonight. And I've got a cast on both wrists. I'm supposed to be wearing a sling for the broken collarbone. And I have to sit there and type and answer the telephone. And guess what his profession was when he wasn't a mission president? A doctor. Absolutely. He was a doctor. So he didn't say, how are you doing, Sister Bodie? How is your shoulder coming along? He didn't ask me about any of those things. I just had to live with it and do it. So Jim talked to him and asked him, could he not make things a little bit easier in the office for me? Because we didn't have a real filing cabinet. There was a very heavy desk with wooden drawers. And the bottom drawer is where the stuff was filed. It was right down here. And I had to pull it out with this broken collarbone, because this wrist had had surgery. Pull it out. And then the files were in sideways. So my husband said, can we have a real filing cabinet? That would help her a little bit. And I came up with a system for filing the missionaries' letters to make it easier for me, because filing is hard when you've got all these injuries, right, you know? And I said, I've got a concertina file with A, B, C, D, you know, alphabetized. When I open the letters for your present, what about if I put all the A's in the A section and all the B's and so on and so on, and then when you read them, you take out the A's, read them, mark them up, and then put them back in the A file, and then take out the B's and do the same thing. And he said, okay, I'll give it a try. And so a couple of days later, he came back and he said, your system doesn't work for me. So it didn't matter whether it worked for me, it didn't work for him. He couldn't go that extra mile to do that for me. And so I was really hurt, and I started to wonder, why did God want me to go on a mission to Africa and then take away my skills to do the job the very, very next day? Why would he do something like that? You know, God doesn't do those kinds of things to us, does he? He doesn't have us born with Down syndrome or have us born gay or anything like that. He doesn't do that stuff. Yeah, he does. And I have heard so many times from people saying, God takes care of his missionaries. Well, he doesn't. He doesn't. We had that accident on the second day. There was another young man who came into the same mission it was November, December time. And he came in on Wednesday, and on Friday he was dead in a car accident. There were missionaries that hit cows driving, because we were in, you know, rough area in South Africa. And there was one young man who was holding a mattress in the back of a pickup truck because they were moving to a different flat. And the wind took it, and it took him too, and he was killed. God does not take care of his missionaries in the Mormon church. Don't believe that. And your family will not be blessed while you're gone. Don't they teach you that? Your family will be blessed. If you love them, go on a mission. And the Lord will bless them. Well, my son-in-law died while we were on our mission. We had the accident on the 7th. I'll get control, I will. We had the accident on the 7th of April. And my son-in-law got worse and worse. And I could have stopped saying that's terrible. And on the 3rd of July, a new mission president came in to the mission. And I thought, I'm going to get along with this guy. Things are going to work. It's going to be better now. For sure, it's going to be better. And so on the 4th of July, when he hadn't taken over yet, that was when the mission president went home, I got the call from my daughter, deep breath, saying, my sweetheart got his independence today. And I called my mission president, and they said, you know, we could come over. So we went over to the mission home. This is the new one. And he's like, I'm sorry, Sister Bodhi. Shoulder hug right on this broken shoulder that I had just had plated together about 5 or 6 days before that. But he didn't mean to do that. But like, it was that, you know, that sort of male hug thing, you know. And I got no card, no flowers. When we had the accident, the mission couples that were in the office brought some flowers in, but there were other couples all over. Nobody sent us a get well card. Nobody sent us any flowers. Nobody said, oh, we just admire you so much for staying. There wasn't any credit given for staying, but we thought we should. Why do you think we stayed under those circumstances? Because people have said to me, well, you were free to come home. Why did we stay? Guilt, indoctrination,
the way to perfection.
The way to perfection. Your family's going to be blessed. My son-in-law had cancer before we left. Everybody thought that he was going to live, except for me. I had to go because I had to save my son-in-law. What a stupid way to think, hey? You know, but that's what they taught, is that, you know, if you make sacrifices for the Lord, things will work right for your family. And if I didn't go on a mission, maybe he would die, and then it would be my fault because I was so faithless. So I went, and then after the accident, I'm thinking, is this another test? Is God testing me? Like, what if I don't stay and then Mark will die. Well, of course he died anyway, but that was the beginning of our mission, and it was the beginning of the downfall for me, because I couldn't believe that God would do this to me. You know, I just couldn't believe that he would take away my ability to do the job that he called me to do since I was 12 years old. That was how I looked at it, because I'd got a mission call to where I wanted to go. And so I wondered how I could give up now after my son-in-law died. I'd stayed there through the accident, and then my son-in-law died. Well, should I go home now? Should I be with my daughter? Should I go home? No, I stayed. I stayed because I was supposed to stay, because God wanted me there, and the Lord wanted me there, and I'd been called by a prophet to go there. So I stayed, and I didn't go home and support her to my everlasting shame. Anyway, once I was working in the office, albeit in very slow motion, I started to learn my duties through this haze of pain pills and stuff like that. And I discovered that one of the things that was left for me to do was to write the letter that goes home to missionaries' parents or missionaries' children. There's always a letter that goes that says, your son or daughter has arrived and safely, and they're now serving in the so-and-so area, and blah, 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 all that stuff. Well, I had to type that letter up. Sorry, but keep touching my microphone. I had to type that letter up myself, and it was a form letter. And it just said, your loved ones have arrived safely, and they're serving in the office, sort of thing. And I said to the mission president, I can't send this to my children. You know, not under these circumstances. I can't send them that letter. And he said, well, you don't get the special letter till the end of your mission. I'm like, oh. So I said, well, I just can't. I mean, it's obviously a form letter if I send it that way. It's a form letter, and it wouldn't look good for him, would it? If I did that, it wouldn't look good for the mission president to be sending, because he signs it, to send home a letter saying we'd arrive safely and all the rest of it. So he said, oh, type up what you want, I'll sign it. So I had to make up something and pretend it came from him, and he signed it, and off it went to our son. So that was how that part went. And so then we didn't know what to do. As I say, it was just the second day. We didn't know what the legal ramifications were in this country. What do you do when you get in an accident? You know, like, how do you do that? So I phoned the area office in Johannesburg and asked to speak to the lawyer there, and asked him if he could give us some help and direction. He said, no, I can't do that. I said, well, surely you know something about the law? No, I don't know anything about the law. I don't know what you're supposed to do. What do you think I should have done at that point? Yeah, that too. she did this just for you. I think I should have said, oh my goodness, what should I have said? No, they wouldn't help. They had no offer of help. And so then, because I had all these casts and things, once the other couple went home, and we were working in the office, and we had our own flat to take care of, and our own grocery shopping, and our own laundry. They got us a washing machine, but we had no dryer, so I had to hang the clothes on the line with this. And it was very, very painful. It was just awful. And I was so sad, because they weren't taking care of us. And I thought they would. I thought, I expected to go on a mission and be loved. That's what I expected. And I didn't feel any love. I just didn't feel it. But not from the members there. I'm not referring to the members. The members were awesome. And as somebody else said today, Mormons are wonderful people. They really are. And I really, really do love them. I'm not away from the church because I hate Mormon people. I'm away from the church because of the things that we've heard today. It's the lies and all of that stuff. That's why I've left. And anyhow, so I asked, could we have the mission home's maid come over once a week to come and help us? Just make the you know, put clean sheets on the bed, give it a once over for us. And so the mission president said he'd think about that, came back to me and he said, nope, sorry, can't do it. And I mean, like this, I'm not exaggerating, that's the way he would talk. Nope, can't do that. And I said, why not? And he said, well, essentially, she would be working for the church if she was working for you. And so if anything happened to her, the church would be responsible and liable to be sued. What should I have done? Sued the church. But I didn't. I didn't, because it's like suing God, right? And nobody from the legal department said, well, you need to sue the church insurance or anything like that. They're not going to tell me to do that, right? So they didn't. So that that whole thing happened, and it, yeah, let's just whiz by this stuff. I should have sued, though. I was working for the church, and it never occurred to me to ask until after I left the church. I was working for the church. Who was responsible for me? You know, I was hurt in their vehicle. I didn't have any choice about being in that vehicle. I was told to go to conference. We just traveled for 34 hours, but we still had to go to conference that very night. And we had to go the very next day, all day, until 8 o'clock at night, and it happened on the way home. So I felt like, who loves me here? Only Jim. And I cried all the time. And part of it was post-concussion syndrome and post-traumatic stress, because I was frightened to death on the roads because of having the accident so soon. So, yeah, it was pretty nasty. Okay, so I had the surgery on the shoulder. They put a plate in it to put it to keep it together, which is what I had in the wrist here. And then they had to cut this bone, make it shorter to match the other one, because I couldn't feel my fingers, and it was really hard to type and not be able to feel my fingers. So they did surgery on here too. So I had that to deal with as well. And then later, I had one more surgery in Port Elizabeth to take the plate out of my shoulder. So it's four surgeries in 18 months on the mission, and very, very little recuperation time, and not being able to have physiotherapy on a regular basis. I couldn't have that. So after I came to the first conference in 2008, and we had the open mic time, that open mic time is just incredible, isn't it? When you feel what other people feel, and I just felt so empowered. I just had to get up there, you know? And I said, and some of you may remember this. I'm a bit ashamed that I did it, but not really very much. I was at the time, because I wasn't out as much then. But I said, I am taking back my authentic life from these men who have controlled me all of my life. And that goes back to my father, my first husband who beat me. It just goes all the way down the line that I was abused, and now I was being abused by church leaders. And I was like, oh, this is just too much to take, you know? And I was really angry with God. I was really, really angry with him. And I was trying to get a relationship back with him. And it wasn't happening except for my own emotions, because I had to get back right with God because I was a missionary. And so I was forcing the issue and imagining that I was feeling different, you know. Anyway, so when I got home from the mission, it was very sad. It was really gut-wrenching to leave, because I'd worked through all that stuff. And in the second half of our mission, we were moved to Port Elizabeth. And in Port Elizabeth, they called Jim to be the branch president of a township branch. And so we had to travel 41 kilometers a day in the car to go to the township that we had previously been told not to visit. Couples shouldn't go to townships because they're dangerous. But now we're there every day up until the dark at nighttime. And we did that. Because I didn't have a calling, because he was branch president, I didn't have a missionary companion anymore. So it was like, what shall I do, you know? So I sewed baptismal dresses that were torn and things like that, and went and helped in primary, helped in Relief Society, just sort of did my thing. And then I started doing something that was what I wanted to do all along. I started doing my own humanitarian work. I was bugging the area office to send seeds. Now, I want you to picture this. in Africa. I want you to picture it. These people, they live in a township. They've got a piece of ground around their hut or their house or whatever it is. They could grow gardens for food. But what do you need before you grow a garden? Seeds and?
Water.
And? Tools. Tools. And they had no money for any of that. So I was saying to the humanitarian people, send help for them. We can help them. We know about gardening. We can help them to start gardens and things like that. No help. It was always like, we'll contact this place. We'll contact this office, this person, whatever. No help was coming. And you know, even if they had done all of those things, sent all of those things, the animals that roam free would have eaten the gardens. So then they would have needed fences as well. But could the church afford seeds, tools, fences? Water? Oh, yeah, they could afford it. They didn't do it. They just didn't. They didn't help. The baptismal fonts, the water in the black branches was cold, freezing cold. You can't believe how cold it gets in South Africa if you haven't been there in the winter. It's really cold. The next continent is Antarctica. And it blows right in there, and it's really a very cold place. But they had cold water, and these people bath in little bowls on the floor. They stand in the bowl and they do a strip down wash. So they've never been in deep water, and now they're in this freezing cold deep water, tensed up. But the white ward, oh, they had a lovely baptismal font, and the water was lovely and warm. They had all the lovely things. I heard a church leader say, I think that AIDS is the answer to the problems in South Africa. It'll get rid of the unemployment issues and blah, blah, blah. AIDS is a great humanitarian answer, isn't it? So that was upsetting. That was really upsetting to think that. So when I came home, I fell into this deep depression because I didn't feel like we'd done any good. I didn't feel like we'd helped anybody. All we'd done was run a ward, and the younger missionaries were baptizing people, and they were in one door and out the other, and if they stayed, then somebody else left. The numbers never seemed to change. It just went up and down, up and down, up and down. But the church leaders were like, Africa is the highest baptizing, that's the highest place that we're baptizing, highest numbers. And that was, I mean, you know, that's the whole goal, isn't it? It's to get more numbers. This is the part that made me really sad. And when I came home, I thought about it so much. People, good Mormon people, pay into the PEF, the Perpetual Education Fund. And you think that your money is going to help people there? I begged them for the Perpetual Education Fund for the people in this township. And they said, well, you have to have the couple come from Johannesburg and teach them about this. And I'm like, okay, well, can we do that? And nothing, we'll talk to this department. Nothing happens. So we come home. I'm thinking about all of this stuff, the Perpetual Education Fund, the fact that it didn't help, my husband's tears. At the tiny, tiny amounts of tithing that adults were paying. These people are hungry. They're hungry and they're sick and they need medicine. And they're asking them to pay tithing. Five rands makes a Canadian dollar, which is close to the American one. And it's made up of cents. And there were adults paying 10 cents. So, like, I'm not very good at math, so I can't give you any numbers on that. But 10 cents, isn't that what you said, honey? Like 10 cents somebody paid? And it just moved him to tears to think that they were faithful enough to pay 10 cents that represented 10% of their money. And one girl was going to save some of her dinner to offer it for fast offering. And she probably only got to eat once a day, but she was going to save some of her dinner and give it to somebody else that was poor. And she had nothing. There was a little orphan girl there that we just loved to pieces. She was 18. And her last parent had just died. And she was living alone in this house. And she was scared. And the township's a scary place. There's a lot of rape and stuff like that. She was really very scared. And so Jim knew how the welfare fund operates because he was a bishop in... in Canada. And so he got out the checkbook and he arranged for some shopping to be done to feed these people, to feed this orphan girl and a couple of other families. And he was praised for it by the, he wasn't a stake president then because it was, what do you call it, district leader. He was praised for his work that he did on that basis. But when we left and they had a black branch president, he didn't get the checkbook. The checkbook was taken away. Because we went back again. Because after this bout of depression, I lifted out of it and I thought, we've got to go back. We've got to do something good. We just can't leave it this way. You know, like, I couldn't stand it. So I felt like God was calling me back again. Really, it was my own heart that was saying, you've got to go back and do some good. But I felt like I had a calling. So I talked to my bishop. And I said, I want to, I feel like God wants me to go back and teach sewing and, you know, help the women to get some skills. Because over in Africa, as you heard Jeff saying, you know, about the conditions and the AIDS and that kind of thing, the women over there are the ones that get AIDS the most, okay? They get it more than men. And they do here, too. And I want to tell you something, AIDS is on the rise. And women of around 50 and up are getting AIDS here. And the reason for it is because they don't think they're going to get pregnant, so they don't use any birth control, and they're getting AIDS. So when Jeff was talking about condom use, the church had us teaching people the same principle that you were talking about. Basically, cross your legs, you know, that's what it is. Just don't do it, and then you won't get it. But husbands cheat on wives. Wives cheat on husbands. Women get raped, so they get it. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but rape is used in Africa as a strategy of war. You know, and it's not just a tactic, it's a strategy. They do it on purpose to give them AIDS. So those people who are working in the mines and stuff, those slaves still today, black slaves, are being guarded by black armies who are getting money from other sources, the people who want what they're mining. And to keep their slaves under control, what they do is they rape the women. If the men just start acting up and want to be free, they rape the women and they give them AIDS. It's a strategy of war. It's to keep it going. And all of our things that we have, like our cell phones and stuff like that, the stuff comes from Africa, the minerals that they use, and we are funding wars in Africa with our use of those things. And I think it's really something that we need to think about, that these armies will... They're so poor, the people there, they'll do anything to even be those armies, just like in concentration camps, you know, when they go and help the people and help the enemy. If you want to stay alive, you've got to do something, and they do that kind of thing. So anyway, I when I talked to my bishop, this was his comment. If you're going to get a call like that from the Lord, you know how that's going to come to you, don't you? Through the brethren. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just a woman, hey? I just can't get a call by the Lord. I can't hear his voice. I can't hear him telling me that I need to go back and do some good instead of just getting numbers and tithing. So I quoted scripture to him, you know, like about being a slothful servant if you needed to be commanded in all things and stuff like that. I quoted a bit of scripture. And then ignored him, and fortunately, my sweet husband was behind me, and he said, if we're going to go back, we need to do microcredit, honey. That's the key. So we went to BYU, we took the course on microcredit, which is really good because microcredit is awesome. It is really an awesome technique for getting people out of poverty. And you take it to the poorest of the poor, which is the opposite to what Jeff was saying that the family does. Instead of going trickle down, it's trickle up. When you empower the people at the bottom, then the wealth trickles up and the country improves. But they don't improve because they keep that top-down thing all the time. But it's improving, okay? It does get better. Just imagine if your husband or wife stepped out on you and had an affair and you went to the doctor, and the doctor said, I'm sorry, but you've got AIDS. And you say, well, what happens now? And he says, well, you're going to die. Do you think that would happen here in North America? Would that happen? No, it wouldn't. The doctors would say, you need to go on ARVs right away, antiretrovirals. You need to go on them right away. It wouldn't happen here. But in Africa, they're forgotten. Nobody cares. Nobody cares because they're controlling them with the AIDS. And they're controlling their sex lives by telling them not to do it. Well, you know, you live in a township. There's no theater. There's no nice place to go shopping and stuff like that. And sex is free and it's fun. And that's what they do. They're human beings. They're human beings. They have feelings and emotions and they do it. Why don't they tell them, use condoms, you know? Then the Pope goes visiting and he tells them that using condoms is wrong. And I'm like, ah, idiot. So Jim's going to show another little clip of a film right now that I want you to watch. It's very short. Just about a whole generation of young people have vanished in Africa like that. Who's going to take care of the babies when these people die? And the babies themselves, when they're born with AIDS, if they don't get medicine right away, they die before their second birthday. Jim and I went to the graveyard because one of our friends died from our mission. When we went back again on this project, we called it the Cinzio Project, by the way. And when we went back, that one of our friends had died. And so we went to the graveyard and we looked at the graves and just rows and rows and rows of new graves. And it was people that were between 20 and 40 and babies. That's what you're seeing there. Just loads of people. They're just disappearing off the earth because nobody cares about them. And when the church sends missionaries, it's just to get them in there and get them paying tithing. There's not, as far as I know, and I could be wrong, but I didn't see any palliative care. There was no orphanages by the church. And the church talks about its humanitarian efforts. You know how they put it on at conference and they show all their good deeds in the world, you know? Well, they do some good deeds, they do, and it's good PR, but where it's really needed, why don't they send humanitarian missionaries to Africa to run orphanages, to take care of people who are dying of AIDS? Why don't they do that? No, see, they don't really care about the people in Africa. What they are doing is what Jeff said, they're taking care of the elite here. That's what they're doing. We have bishop's storehouses. Jeff might not know that. When an LDS person gets out of work or something like that, you can go to your bishop and say, we don't have any money. And he'll say, okay, well, we'll send the Relief Society president and she'll look in your cupboards and see what you've got and then fill out a form. And then you go to the bishop's storehouse and you get food. And that's for people like this who have a social safety net and families, and it's not in a country that's poverty-stricken and ravaged with AIDS. They don't have it. We do. What's wrong with this picture? You know, there's something really, really wrong with that picture. Okay. So, okay. So when I came to that first conference in 2008, that some of you remember me making that comment about, I said something like, and taking back my authentic life that I was talking about from the men who'd allowed to run it and ruin it for so many years. And those might not have been the actual words that I said, but that was what I was meaning. And I forgot what I was going to say. So I'll pass it on to Jim for the next film, please. Next film clip. This was me from the film that Dennis is showing in there, In the Shadow of the Temple. It's an outtake. This was me back in 2008. Basket case.
We're kind of a divided family. We've got the Eskimos and the Mos. And we used to go carol singing together. Our family sings harmony together. And we're great. We're as good as the tabernacle, right? When we went carol singing, our friends used to say, "Oh, it's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, come on in." And then they would request songs, and my kids have beautiful voices. And so we used to sing together, and now there's absolutely no harmony left. We're just a divided family. I wish we were together, but I can't go back into their belief system.
That was the mess that I was then, and this is the mess that I am today. But I had to do something about that, because you can't stay in that place. That place is way too painful. And I know there's a lot of people here, I'm not mentioning names, but people here who have loved me and supported me through that time. And I was telling Jim this last night. I said, those people saved my life, because I really did. When I first left the church, I wanted to die. I wanted to commit suicide. So I relate to Jim Whitefield when he talks about how he felt, how Kat saved him from dying. And you saved me from dying, because I had pills and I was in pain emotionally and physically, and I thought, I just as well do it, you know, just as well die. But I had all this support and you're awesome people. So today, I'm happy. I mean, I'm teary, but I'm happy. I am so glad to be done with the church. I'm so glad that people don't think of me as a Mormon when they hear Packer say those wicked things about people, those hateful things. I have friends who are gay that I love dearly, and I feel their pain when I hear that. I feel that. And that's the thing, you see. I love people, and I want to be loved back. I want people to love me. And so when I was in Africa the first time, I got love when we went to the township. That's where I got love. That's where I got close to the people. Once we were sent out to Port Elizabeth, I had so much time to sit down and talk to the girl that had been raped, to the girl that was pregnant, to the woman who'd lost her husband and now she was raising the kids. But you know what I didn't know? I didn't know that there were grandmothers raising orphans. That little film clip that you saw said that there were 13 million orphans. That figure is out of date. As of 2005, that was. 2010 is 14 million. That doesn't sound like a lot, but a million is a heck of a lot. So now the grandmothers are getting younger. It was the old grandmas that had missed the AIDS epidemic. But now the grandmothers are younger. Like, how many people are under 40 here and are grandmothers? Anybody? I was under 40 when I became... No, I wasn't. I was just over 40. Yeah, yeah, when I became a grandmother. And so the grandmothers there are young too, and they were around in the AIDS epidemic. So they're raising grandkids, and they've got AIDS. Their grandkids have AIDS. They've buried their children with AIDS. Like, what are we going to do? Are we going to stand by and let this happen in the world? Do we not care? Are we going to take that leader's attitude that it may be the solution to Africa's problems? I can't do that. Maybe some people can, but I can't do that. And so do you wonder why you gave all your money and your time and your talents to the church? So any of you now say, why did I do that? Man, I want my tithing back. You know, I could do such good work in Africa if I had all my tithing back, you know. And so after that conference, when I took back my life, I went home and I got a lawyer. And I said, I have this story to tell you. And I told the lawyer about my accident in Africa. And I said, I don't know if there's anything I can do about it. And he said, yes, there is. He said, we can sue the church. And but we couldn't sue them for the accident because the statute of limitations had run out. So it was their lack of care afterwards. Because it was like, this is Dennis Lavery's word, actually, sanctuary trauma. You know, it's like a priest in the Catholic Church molesting children. When you don't take care of the people that you've got stewardship over, that is really abusive. And so the lawyer considered it so, and he said he would take it on a contingency basis. And so we started this lawsuit. Well, this lawyer was really sloppy, didn't get back to me very much, and I'm going to say his name right here. His name is Joseph Shaplawi. If anybody in Canada is ever thinking about hiring him, don't. Okay? He kept me hanging on a string until about a month and a half ago. And I wasn't hearing from him. I knew that a lawyer had been appointed for the church, and nothing was happening, so I wrote to him, I phoned him, he never got back to me, never got back to me, never got back to me. Finally, I sent him this really shitty email, and I said, I'm fed up with this, I'm just so fed up with waiting around for you, you know, what is happening, what's going to happen here? And so he called me right back, and he said, I've moved to a different branch of law, and I'm going to have to drop your case. So, there you go. Like, I don't know what happened. I'm not making any accusations, but he dropped the case. I don't know why he did that. He moved to a new branch of law. Okay, so moving on from that. So then I thought, okay, I can't stay in this painful place, not helping, not doing anything. And they're in Canada. There's an organization called the Stephen Lewis Foundation. Stephen Lewis was the UN envoy to Africa for AIDS. But when he retired from that, he began the Stephen Lewis Foundation. And what they do, what they started, him and his daughter, around her kitchen table, they came up with this marvelous plan, and it's called the Grandmothers to Grandmothers Campaign. Now, I'm a grandmother. I've got 12 grandchildren. I only see 5 of them. I don't see most of the others because I've left the church. But I love my grandchildren, but I would not want to raise them. I'm a grandmother now. I'm not a mother anymore. I've only got a certain amount of energy. I don't want to raise them. There are grandmothers in Africa that are 90 years old that are raising grandchildren because they're still alive and the kids aren't. They've died of AIDS. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to get involved with them. I'm going to get involved with the Grandmothers Campaign and see if I can do some work. So I thought all I was going to be doing was fundraising. They make things and they make money and they send it off to the foundation. I thought that was going to be my calling. But then they said, there's going to be this first ever gathering on African soil, an AIDS conference for grandmothers, the ones who are grief-stricken because they've lost their children and they're raising their AIDS orphaned grandchildren. So they had this conference in Africa. Aeroplan paid for the tickets for lots of African grandmothers to get to Swaziland from 14 different countries. And I was chosen to be a delegate from these 140 groups across Canada. And I got to be one of the 42 delegates that went to Swaziland this spring to facilitate this. Now, this was so much different. Like, these people really want to help. They really want to do something. It's not just lip service. They really want to help. They get the projects going. They get the gardens going. They have grief counseling. They have counseling for kids who've been raped and for kids who have AIDS. They have all of that stuff, all the stuff that I wanted the church to have when I was there. They have it. And there's lots of NGOs doing things like that. And I'm going, why are NGOs doing that and not the stinking rich church? Why are they building their big and spacious buildings when people are going hungry and need medicines, you know? Why is that? Aren't they supposed to love those people? No, they don't love them. They don't love them. They only want them on the rolls. They just want to bring the numbers up. So, well, you know how desperately you needed somebody to talk to when you left the church? You remember, you wanted someone who understood what you were feeling. And when you come together at a conference like this, it's like such a surge of helpful energy because you know that everybody is with you. They understand what you went through. That's what this did for these African grandmothers. They've suffered so much, and they got to travel for the first time in a plane. They got to go to Swaziland. The Queen Mother of Swaziland and the princesses came to the first night of the gathering. The Queen Mother came down and danced with us. in the audience, and the people that put it on were the Swazi people. And the leader of that organization, well, I think she's the leader, Sipiwe, has AIDS, but she's on ARVs, and she pushes herself to the max. She is a powerful, wonderful woman. She's so strong. And she planned all of this, and they had meals, they decorated this beautiful thing, and then we went on a solidarity march. Okay, this is good works. This is really good works. This does something. This is not that silly, time-wasting stuff that you do when you're in the temple making dead people able to go to heaven. This is, you know, this is real help. You spend 3 hours with an organization like the Stephen Lewis Foundation instead of 3 hours going through the temple or whatever, 2-3 hours, whatever it is. Like, you can do more good for humanity. And that's what we need to do. When we break out of the mold, we don't become bad people. We are not bad people. We are good people. And we've left the church, but we don't need to leave that goodness behind. We still need to use it for the world. And don't you find that you feel more connected to people in the world now than you ever did? Yeah, isn't it an awesome feeling? And don't you find you're more interested in politics and what's happening here and what's happening there? I was such a dumb Mormon wife. I didn't know anything. I really didn't. I didn't know anything that was going on in the world. I had no idea that all these grandmothers were raising orphan kids, you know? I did not know that, but I got smart. So, yeah, when we left, the umbilical cord had been cut. But we were still infants, and so we needed each other, and that's what these women have. And we still need to do good. Did you pay your tithing and all that good stuff so that you could go to heaven? Or did you do it because you cared? So you could go to heaven. Really, that's what it amounted to. They legislated how much you should pay, 10% of your wages, and you needed to pay to this thing and this thing. You weren't doing it out of the goodness of your heart. You knew that you were going in for an interview at the end of the year, and if you wanted to go to the temple and you wanted to be at your kid's wedding, you had to answer the questions right. So that's the way that I see it now. But, you know, I didn't at the time, but that's the way that I see it now. So when we did our solidarity march, there was all these women, and you're going to see it on a film. Do we have time, Jim? Okay. We were chanting, Pesu Komkono. Pesu Komkono. Pesu Komkono. Can you say it? Pesu Komkono. I'll tell you what it means. Raise your arms, women. That's what it means. Pesu Komkono. Raise your arms, women. How strong are you? What can you do? Anything. Anything, right? You can do anything. So now, that's what we have to do. We're not being told what to do anymore. We're not being told to go to the temple, pay tithing, do this and that. It's got to come from in here. And now we have to go do some good. So take in those orphaned, those gay children that are kicked out of their homes. Take them in. Take care of them. Do something for them. Do some good. You know, whatever it is that you choose, do something. And then a lot of that pain leaves your heart. And you just feel like you're doing something for the world. And it doesn't matter how small it is. Just do something. So, what was it? Pesu Komkono. Pesu Komkono. Women, hold up your arms. Now you watch these wonderful women in this film and you'll just be touched. I'm sure you will. Can you imagine what a wonderful experience that was for me to go to that and to do something that really helped? It just changed my whole outlook. Has anybody ever heard of Zoomer magazine? It's Canadian. And there's a whole article in here about that in Zoomer magazine. This is for 50 pluses, and it's baby boomers with zip. That's why it's called Zoomer. And it's a great magazine, so they ran an article about it. And this one, this edition, talks about Stephen Lewis, the guy that did that. Can you imagine a man and his daughter sitting around the kitchen table and coming up with this fabulous plan? We can all do it. We can do it. We have the power to do that. To say, let's make a difference. Let's do something good. And so that's my challenge to you, is to just do something, and it makes you feel so much better. So thanks for listening to me today. Okay.